Okay, hi everybody. So let's go back in our memory to the end of Judges, the narrative that ended the book of Judges and that showed us how the entire Israelite nation falls apart in civil war didn't start with a national issue. It started with a family falling apart. First, off stage, we're just told in the beginning of the narrative that the concubine somehow cheated on her husband, master. I'm not even sure what's the right word for that. And that she left him, she left his protection. And the whole story starts when he heads to her father's house to pick her up and start again. And then, after we have this kind of background offstage event that we don't see for ourselves, but hovers above the story, this sense of infidelity, of distance between the two of them, we watch the horrific moment when they are under attack. Men want to rape him, and he pushes her out instead to be raped. And the family falls apart, and following that, the nation falls apart. So perhaps it is appropriate that when we are looking for the turning point from the whole era of the judges, from the whole tragedy that was this passage of generations that forget and don't pass on and fall apart and become tribal and separatist and weak, perhaps it's appropriate that when we hit the turning point from all of that, once again, the point we begin in with is a family. And just like the family that started the end of the book of Judges, this family too has tensions. It's not everything is love, everything is good, everything is happy. This family too has tensions. But as we will see now, instead of breaking them apart, these tensions become the crucible, the catalyst of positive growth. So without further ado, let's delve into the source sheet and start visiting this family together. And we're going to read and pay a lot of attention to the beginning because, as in any story, really, the beginning of a book often includes many of the expectations, many of the hints that the storyteller wants us to then hold on to make sense of the rest of the story. So just as we dwelt a lot on the beginning of Judges, we will dwell now on the beginning of Samuel. And where I'm in the first page of the source sheet, the first source, the very beginning of Samuel. Sorry. There was a man from Ramataim of the Tzufit in the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Yeroham, ben Elihu, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Tzuf, an Ephraimite. So already here we see a change. We talked about how at the end of the book of Judges, at the end of the era of the Judges, slowly people started losing their names, their connection with their fathers and grandfathers and great-great-grandfathers. And then eventually the people became anonymous themselves, because if you lose your connection to your past, your identity itself is compromised. So here we meet a person who has an identity. We know who he is, we know where he's from, and we know the name of the names of the people who birthed them, well, the men, of course, who birthed them several generations up. And now starts a family bit. He had two wives, one named Hannah and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah was childless. This man used to go from his town every year to worship and to offer sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh. This is another significant sentence, because what we saw towards the end of Shoftim was also that the ritual center was forgotten. We see Micha building an idol and creating an alternative ritual center in his own house. Later, we saw an entire tribe, the tribe of Dan, taking that idol and turning that into their central place of ritual up north in Israel. We're even told explicitly that this alternative ritual center existed for as long as the tabernacle in Shiloh stood. And we keep hearing that Bayamim ahem, Isha yashar be'enaf yaseh. In those days, everyone did what was right in their own eyes, which is an allusion to a verse in Deuteronomy that tells us, don't do what's right in your own eye, but rather bring your sacrifices in the right place. In other words, this also reminds us that people forgot. what it is to have a ritual center. And yet here we have a man who not only knows who he is and is rooted in his family history and in his land, he also is committed, not occasionally, but regularly, every year, to go to the ritual center. The sages make more of it. The sages point out that there's this weird expression here that says that he went, here I'm finding it in the English, miyamim yamima in the Hebrew, and in English, every year. And the sages say that it wasn't, why is it so emphasized that he went regularly? Why is it not just enough to say, Vayale kol shana, he went every year? Why draw attention to it? And they suggest that he made a big deal out of it, not to be proud, not to display his fidelity, but rather to inspire other people to go with him. And they even create this beautiful story as interpretation, saying that every year he would take a different path. He would walk in a different way to the tabernacle, the ritual center in Shiloh, so that he would stop to sleep in different towns along the way and inspire the people to come with him and bring sacrifices and participate in this unifying experience of having one place where everybody approaches God and comes close to God together, out of some sort of a mission to bring the people together. But even if we don't take this midrashic reading, the sage's reading here, it's clear that the man is committed and he's centered and he's rooted. And then we're told, the narrative jumps and tells us, Hophni and Pinchas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord there. And this is an interesting thing, because why is it relevant? Why do we care? If we're talking about a man named Elkanah, and this is his story, what do we care about the people who happen to be priests in Eli, in Shiloh, sorry, at this particular time? Why do we care that they are the sons of Eli, named Hophni and Pinchas? In his book about narrative in the Bible, in the book called Narrative Arc in the Bible by Shimon Bar Efrat, a wonderful scholar, he points out that the Bible is very, very sparing in its language. The Hebrew Bible doesn't say things in exposition just so, just in order to tell us something beautiful. It's not the Iliad, where every time Achilles is mentioned, we get a long set of couplets telling us all kinds of random things about him or about anyone mentioned really in the narrative. No, in the Hebrew Bible, we're given the minimum necessary, the minimum, absolute minimum necessary about every person. So why is it mentioned here? And he suggests that there's a hint, a foreshadowing here. Eli's two sons are mentioned at the beginning of the narrative of the birth of Shmuel, though they play no part in the actual narrative. The fact that Eli's two sons are mentioned at this point appears to indicate that Shmuel, whose birth is encountered in this narrative, and we will recount it, sorry, and we'll get to it soon, will eventually take their place, in that it is he, not they, will inherit Eli's position. Now, we will see how that comes to pass, but even if we don't necessarily see that already here, we are reminded, in a sense, that even if the family we're focusing right now on is the family of Elkanah, the first chapter here is actually, or the whole scene that we're about to encounter, is the tale not of one family, but of two families. We will see what happens to Elkanah's family, but there's another family in the background ready to be used by the storyteller in some way as foil. And this is Eli's family of a father and two sons. But let's stick with the main family for now. We'll come back to them soon. I'm in verse 4 here. One such day, sorry, I'll make it a little bigger. One such day, Elkanah offered a sacrifice. He used to give portions to his wife Pnina and all of her sons and daughters. But to Hana, he would give one portion only. Though Hana was his favorite, for the Lord had closed her womb. Now, if we've been reading the book of Judges carefully, this should be a big flashing red light for us. Because once again, we're witnessing a tension in a family. And every time we saw a tension in a family, especially in the second half of the book of Judges, it ended very badly. It ended with Elimelech, Gideon's son, killing all 70 of his brothers, or almost all 70 of his brothers. It ended with Micha and his mother creating idolatry. It ended with the horrific rape of the concubine. So here we see the tension, and we're afraid of what's going to happen. And it's the storyteller is giving us, is creating in us all this tension of, oh no, not again. Let's keep reading. This happened year after year. Every time she went up to the house of the Lord, the other would taunt her so that she wept and would not eat. Imagine the bitterness that accumulates year after year in this way. Her husband Elkanah said to her, Hannah, why are you crying and why aren't you eating? Why are you so sad? Am I not more devoted to you than 10 sons? Let's pause here for a moment. Why does a storyteller who's about to tell us a story about the rise of kings, the story about the geopolitical change of the entire region, the story of how from this anarchic era of the judges we're about to emerge into dynasties, why does it start with this one random family? Why bring us into the small micro level of a family history when we have the history of an entire kingdom waiting to be explored? So yes, we need to introduce Shmuel, who the prophet, who will become the man who anointed the first two kings in this history. But why couldn't we just say there was a man named Shmuel who was a prophet, and then he did this and he did that? Something in this story holds the key both to understand why things change moving forward, but also to understand the dangers that continue to lurk in the background or underneath the surface as that change takes place. And in order to understand that, to understand both the solution to the problem of the judges and why the solution is imperfect, what we need to understand is what Hannah does next and why it is significant. Here she stands, taunted by the other wife of her husband, childless, sad, supported by her husband, who in a striking contrast to the husband of the concubine, who upon seeing her lying across the threshold said, get up, let's go, before realizing she was lying there dead. We see a husband who tries to be supportive and says something that may appear insensitive to some of us, but is clearly meant well, meant ill goodwill here. And the question is, what's going to happen? Is she become vindictive? Is she going to attack the other wife? Is she going to become bitter? Is she going to become desperate? Is she going to take matters into her own hands in some way? And then she does something remarkable. She refuses to accept comfort. Elkanah tells her, here we are. We're in this reality. This is a status quo as we know it. Within this status quo, yes, you're disadvantaged in the sense that you don't have sons, but you have a loving husband. So it's not all bad. Accept it. Come to terms with it. Be with me here in this reality. And Hannah refuses to accept that. Let's look at what she does next. I am in box 2 in the source sheet. After they had eaten and drunk at Shiloh, Hannah rose. But the come, the word that the Hebrew uses here, it means more than rose. It means she stood up, yes, she got up. But it's a word that time and again appears in the Bible to signify someone about to take a great action. When people are about to embark on a significant course of action, or they're about to change reality in some way, it's often said that they stand up. Vatakam, vayakam, vayakumu. They stand up. So this is a word that wants us to perk up and pay attention. The priest Eli was sitting on the seat near the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. Why are we told that? Why is that a relevant piece of information? We will see in a second. In her wretchedness, she prayed to the Lord, weeping all the while. And she made this vow. O Lord of hosts, if you will look upon the suffering of your maidservant and will remember me and not forget your maidservant, and if you will grant your maidservant a male child, I will dedicate him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor shall ever touch his head. I want to pause here again and point out that this vow is kind of chutzpahtik in a sense, because she's not saying, God, I am nothing, or God, I'm so sad, do what's right in your own eyes. She tells him, this is what I want. If you give it to me, I'll do something good for you also. There's a certain demanding quality in her vow. And it's almost as if she's creating an opening for God to speak up. She's demanding a response. She's not just saying, God, please help me, which is a much more open-ended thing. She says, here is a contract. You give me a child and I will give him back to you. I signed on the dotted line. Now you do it. I am your slave. I am your maidservant. She's not pretending to be equal with God, but it's not a generalized thing. It's a very specific demand. In a sense, it's reminiscent of a similar vow that Yaakov made once in his life, but we're not going to go there because we don't have time to chase all those different allusions. And the interesting thing is not so much God's response, which is not here yet, but rather the response of the only other person present. And this is that main Eli, Eli HaKohen, Eli the priest, who was sitting, as we heard before, on the seat near the doorpost of the temple of the Lord, literally on the threshold. He is a guardian of the threshold. His job is to make sure who goes in, who goes out, what's going on in that space. And he sees her davening. He sees her making that vow. But he misunderstands the situation. I'm in verse 12. As she kept on praying before the Lord, Eli watched her mouth. Now Hana was praying in her heart. Only her lips moved, but her voice could not be heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Eli said to her, how long will you make a drunken spectacle of yourself? Sober up. And Hannah replied, oh no, my Lord, I am a very unhappy woman. I have drunk no wine or other strong drink, but I have been pouring out my heart to the Lord. Do not take your maidservant for a worthless woman. I have only been speaking all this time out of my great anguish and distress. Then go in peace, said Eli, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him. Somehow, it's not enough for the biblical storyteller here to tell us that Hana prayed for a child and therefore got a child. For some reason, which we will immediately start unpacking, the biblical storyteller creates this human confrontation between Hana, who stands up and prays and makes a contract and offers it up to God and says, please sign on the dotted line, and Eli, who sits there over the threshold and criticizes her. When a storyteller creates a conflict, it's usually there in a way to highlight a certain contrast, especially when there's someone who's clearly the hero, and in this case, the hero or the protagonist is clearly Hana. The other character, the character that confronts them, is in some way a foil, in some way something that's supposed to draw our attention to a difference between the two and thus draw our attention to what's important about the protagonist. And when we look at Hana and Eli here, they really do create mirror images of each other. Think about it. Hana stands up and walks. Eli sits down. Hana demands something bold and apparently behaves in an unorthodox or unconventional way, because otherwise, why would Eli care, right? Why would Eli respond with disdain if what she did was normal and to be expected? In some way, she's breaking convention here. And Eli enforces convention, enforces the way things are, the rules of etiquette for behavior in this situation. Not only that, he is apparently incapable in that moment of even seeing her as anything other than transgressive. All he sees is someone who doesn't walk the line as a line should be. And the only interpretation he can jump to is not a charitable one. He could have reached a charitable interpretation. Presumably, a lot of people came to pray in moments of great emotional distress. After all, this is one of the most natural forms of prayer for any human. Yet that's not what he sees. What he sees, what his mind is trained to see or used to seeing, is you're either doing something a certain way or in some way you're in the wrong. You're drunk. You're uninhibited. You're out of the normal. You're out of the right way of doing things. Now, to his credit, when she tells him what's truly on her mind, he does back off. That should not be de-emphasized, that he does back off and he blesses her and hopes for the good for her. And yet by placing him there in her path, the storyteller draws our attention to the fact that Chana is a transgressive character. She refuses to accept the status quo that her husband wanted her to simply accept. She refuses to just sit down. She stands up and walks instead. She refuses to pray in conventional ways. And she refuses to back up when a man of great authority, the priest of Shiloh, tells her off. She doesn't just meekly say, sorry, sorry, and back off. No, she stands up for herself. She speaks up. And in that moment, we are drawn or we pay attention to the fact that this woman who is about to shape the beginning, was about to shape the direction of the book of Shmuel by making possible Shmuel's birth, by demanding it, from God and defending her right to demand it to the high priest, is unusual. She's not conventional. In some ways, she is like Ruth. We talked about it last week, about how Ruth, when she says, no, I will not stay home, I will not go back to my birth family, I will go with you, Naomi, and join your family, even though it doesn't serve my interest and it's not the expected thing to do and it's not the normal thing to do. So in a sense, Chana follows in the same tradition. She rejects the way things are. And perhaps this is exactly what we need if we want to leave the horrible status quo of judges behind. Because how can you leave the world as it is behind if you're playing by its rules, if you're going only within the path set to you by reality? We need someone like Chana to shake things up and say, reality is not for me. I want something else. I believe that something else can exist, something else can be achieved. I want to take a step back for a second and talk about storytelling once more. Because we're not just talking about history of ideas here. We're not talking about religion and ideas and politics. We're talking about storytelling. So the fact that this story is in the very beginning of the book is significant. The fact that the storyteller uses Eli as a foil for Chana to emphasize her kind of non-conventional ways or convention-breaking ways is significant. But there's something else at play. There's a more primal image at play here. And in order to unpack this more primal image, I want to take a detour for a moment to leave the world of the Bible behind and go a little bit to the world of Joseph Campbell, a wonderful 20th century scholar. We mentioned him in one of our previous classes, who wrote The Hero of a Thousand Faces, where he compared stories from across the board, from Indonesia to America to all kinds of places, and from across millennia of storytelling examples. And he showed how there's certain patterns that repeat themselves in most of them. And one of the things he points out is that the hero of a story is by definition someone who is in some way open to change. I want to show you how he puts it. It's very powerful. A moment. I am here at the bottom of the same box. The hero is a champion of things becoming, not of things become. He does not mistake apparent changelessness in time for the permanence of being, nor is he fearful of the next moment as destroying the permanent with its change. Or in a different place, he says like this, the hero goes forward in his adventure until he comes to the threshold guardian at their entrance to the zone of magnified power. I have to explain this. This is very, it's very weird language here that he uses, very specific professional language. But what he means is this: stories don't work if the hero starts, continues, and ends the story unchanged. Something at the core of story requires that the hero will undergo a process that will demand the hero to become more or other than what they were at the beginning. Try and think about nursery stories from your childhood or any great novel you ever read. If this hero doesn't change at all from beginning to an end, we feel cheated. I've recently been reading a book of fairy tales with my daughter that I bought at a book fair. And it takes all these wonderful fairy tales from around the world and totally bastardize them because it makes it so that nothing is difficult, everything is happy. The heroes start as positive characters and end as positive characters. They're never challenged beyond their initial kind of earnest positivity. And my daughter, who's young, can still feel that something is wrong. She keeps turning the page, expecting something to happen, but then it's the next story instead of continuation of the same. She can feel that the story does not lead to where it's supposed to lead. For a story to happen, change needs to happen, and for that, the hero has to be open to change. But a lot of times, what shapes the story is exactly the tension between the hero being called upon to experience something that will change them and other forces in the hero's life trying to hold it back. Sometimes those other forces are the parents in a lot of fairy tales. It's a evil father who doesn't want to let his daughter get married, right? Sometimes it's political. So it's the evil king who doesn't want to let the young hero rise in the ranks of whatever. Sometimes it's other characters that are in positions of authority. Sometimes it's monsters, dragons, all kinds of creatures. And the role they play is exactly being the guardians of the threshold. If the story starts in some status quo, and then the hero is called upon to change, to step beyond this threshold of the status quo and allow themselves to go into the unknown and change, all those forces are trying to keep him back or her back from crossing this threshold and embarking on a true adventure, on a true process of change. In a sense, this first chapter of Shmuel reads almost like an illustration of this principle because we see the hero, Chana. We see the status quo. We see her living in her reality where she is a wife, but not a mother. And she has this family arrangement and these habits and this yearly pilgrimage she's always part of. And we see two men in her life calling her back, telling her, stay within the safe zone of the way things are. Her husband lovingly and Eli less lovingly. And the latter is literally sitting on the threshold, like a threshold guardian, trying to keep things the way they are, with people praying only in the right conventional way and not stepping beyond that. And Chana says no. Chana rejects that. Chana crosses a threshold into going beyond what's expected of her and what's conventional and what's considered normal. And this is the breaking point that starts the whole process that we will follow in the next few classes. I want to pause here for a second and see if we're going to give more room for questions later. I just want to see if there's anything that should be answered now. Just a moment. There's some comments about the language. I'm not going to go over each one of them, about the language that describes Elkanah's pilgrimage, but is it really every year or does it mean just regularly? I'm not going to go into that. It's all very good questions, and the commentators argue it back and forth because we're trying to stay a little bit on the macro meta level of what's the story trying to do. I can't go into it within the constraints of this class. iPad wrote, so we start with the story of one man to show God is hidden or not so hidden and in her history. I think that's a really good point, that in a sense, by not starting with something grand and big, like a national story where we're more likely to say God is guiding events, but rather with one man and his experience, or as we quickly see, one woman and her experience, we're invited to look underneath the surface. We're invited to look at the small things where God is involved, I would argue that it's more the small things that invite God to be involved. Chana makes the demand. Chana makes the invitation. Okay, there's more questions, excellent questions, but we'll come back to it later. Sorry, what is that? I'm sorry, I don't know what this is. There, I fixed it. I apologize. Okay, but for now, let's keep going. Let's keep going with the class. Okay, God listens to Chana and gives her Hassan. Her breakage, her attack on the way things are, opens her womb, literally opening, making room for new life in the world. And she gives birth to a baby. She keeps him at home for 3 years. She nurses him. And then she brings him with great fanfare to the tabernacle and gives him to Eli to serve in the tabernacle. And this is where the story becomes even more complicated. Because if before we saw it as a story of two families, and we had already the hint in the background that somehow Eli's family is going to become significant, as we saw hinted by the fact that they're mentioned there seemingly without any reason. Hophni and Pinchas are mentioned there seemingly without any reason. Once Shmuel is already in the tabernacle, growing up and working as a servant, as a helper to Eli in the tabernacle. Sorry. Once this is what we see, we're not only, those two families kind of conflate. We're watching at the same time a young man, Chana and Elkanah's son, growing up in the tabernacle, and the two sons of Eli, the men who sat on the threshold and told Chana off, at working in the tabernacle at the same time. Already in the beginning, we saw a little bit how the storyteller weaves those two families together by kind of focusing on Elkanah and then Chana, but mentioning Eli's family here and there through the story. What we see now is the text continues to weave, or in interweave, mentions of all the ways in which Eli's sons were corrupt and horrible people, and the ways in which Shmuel becomes more and more beloved and more acknowledged for being a righteous, upstanding, eager to do the right thing, boy, and then young man. Let's look at it together very briefly. We're not going to read through it like we read through the entire beginning here because it's going to take very long. But I just want to show you how the story does that. We start, I'm in box number 3 in the source sheet. By the way, you have the source sheet in the comments, in the chat. You can find links to the source sheet for those who joined us now. So we start by hearing about how Elkanah and Chana, after bringing Shmuel to the tabernacle, leave. And then immediately we go to talk about Eli's son. We're in the second chapter of Shmuel. I'm starting here in verse 12. Now, Eli's sons were scoundrels. They paid no heed to the Lord. And I didn't include the entire passage that explains in what way they did it, but it's pretty graphic. They kept just grabbing things from people, taking more of the offerings than they were supposed to take, or not at the right times that they were supposed to take it. Just taking, 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 using their position as the guardians of God's rituals to take things for their own benefit. The same cardinal sin that we saw over and over again is haunting the judges' era, the sin of selfishness, of self-serving. And as we hear now, God does not approve of this. The sin of the young men against the Lord was very great, for the men treated the Lord's offering impiously. We would expect, reading the story, that now we would hear responses to this. Okay, we heard a fact. They are bad, corrupt priests using their position for their own benefit. Now, this fact should play out somehow. Something should happen. Somebody should respond. Their father should respond, really. Or somebody else should respond, or God should respond. But instead, the text just cuts away from that and starts talking about Shmuel. Shmuel was engaged in the service of the Lord as an attendant, girded with a linen ephod. His mother would also make a little robe for him, a me'il, a robe, a coat of sorts. And we will see it will come to play a role later. for him and bring it up to him every year when she made the pilgrimage with her husband to offer the annual sacrifice. For the Lord took note of Hannah, she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters. Once her womb opened, it opened up wide. She had more children. Young Samuel, meanwhile, grew up in the service of the Lord. Okay, so now we heard another fact. What does it mean that he grew up in the service of the Lord? What's going to come out of it? Nope. Once again, we jump back to the parallel narrative, the one about Eli's sons. And finally, we hear about Eli actually doing something about it. Now Eli was very old. When he heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel and how they lay with the women who performed tasks at the entrance to the tent of meeting, they're not just taking meat, they're taking advantage of the women who come there. He said to them, "Why do you do such things? I get evil reports about you from the people on all hands. Don't, my sons. It is no favorable report I hear the people of the Lord spreading about. If a man sins against a man, the Lord may pardon him. But if a man offends against God, who can obtain pardon for him? But they ignore their father's plea, for the Lord was resolved that they should die." Eli, who enters the story sitting down on a threshold, trying to enforce a status quo, turns out to be pretty ineffectual when it comes to his own family. We see him telling off Hannah unjustly, and not achieving anything other than, you know, getting her to tell him that he's wrong. Then we see him telling off his sons justly and achieving nothing other than them ignoring what he has to say. And then instead of continuing with that, once again, the text jumps to the parallel story and says, young Samuel, meanwhile, grew in esteem and favor, both with God and with men. In other words, the way the biblical storyteller shapes the beginning of the book of Samuel is by introducing to us two families that represent two ways of life. One is Elkanah's family, or more specifically, Hannah's family. This is the way of life that represents a refusal to just accept the way things are and a determination to create a better future. On the other hand, we have Eli, who represents a certain passivity, a certain sitting down, a certain attempt to just enforce the way things are. But what the story does by interweaving and using these two stories as parallel images and jumping from one to the other is it shows us that this difference is not ethically neutral. One could argue, for example, that yes, while Hannah's attitude is preferable in some way, is better, is more likely to change the world for the better and achieve results, Eli's attitude of sitting down and just trying to enforce the rules is also okay. It's not amazing. It's not going to revolutionize anything for the better, but it will keep things the way they are. It will keep things safe. It'll keep things okay. After all, Eli is the man who is Shmuel's teacher. He raises him, he takes care of him, he is kind to him. We see several instances of that that we don't have time to go into. Why do we have to assume that it's necessarily such a bad way of life? Yet by showing us his sons and by showing us his inability to tell them off effectively, what the story is showing us or drawing our attention to is that passivity has a cost. Sitting down and trying to enforce the way things are is bound to not be good enough because status quos tend to corrupt. In one generation, it'll just be accepting the status quo and sitting down passively and like not trying to change it. But in the next generation, it's already taking advantage of the status quo and your position within it and doing something with it. Now, this is not a necessary rule. But by seeing this progression between Eli and his sons, it makes a very strong suggestion that sitting down is not good enough. It's dangerous. It can lead to a bad result. And indeed, the story continues to explore the results of this. Because what happens, once Eli tries to tell off his sons, and then basically when they ignore him, doesn't do anything further, is that God decides to reject his entire house as his servants. First, God does it by sending someone to tell him that by sending a message to him. And he tells him the following, and this is important for our theme, so I'll go into the text. He tells him, I chose you and your family while we were still in Egypt, while you were still in Egypt. Why are you dishonoring your job? And then he says, and I'm here in box four, and I'm jumping to verse 30. Assuredly, declares the Lord, the God of Israel, I intended for you and your father's house to remain in my service forever. But now, declares the Lord, far be it from me, for I honor those who honor me, but those who spurn me shall be dishonored. A time is coming when I will break your power and that of your father's house, etc., etc. And he also tells him that the sign will be that your two sons will die in one day. And then he says in verse 35, and I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will act in accordance with my wishes and my purposes. I will build for him an enduring house, and he shall walk before my anointed evermore. We spoke today about the way the order of the story shapes our expectations, and how the story weaves two narratives in parallel to create a foil to each other and kind of embody two ways of life, two value system, the one represented by Chana and the one represented by Eli. But here, the story does something else. The storyteller uses language, and in particular, keywords, to help us understand what's the point it's trying to make. Because when God tells Eli off, he uses very particular language. In the English here, we saw, I intended for you and your father's house to remain in my service forevermore. But in Hebrew, it says, Amor amarti, I said, Beitcha u'beit avicha, your father's house, ithalchu lefanai, shall walk before me, ad olam. And then he says in the end that when he's going to make a new priest for himself, Vaithalech lifnei Mashichi, and he shall walk before my anointed evermore. Something about the priestly job, something in the job requirements requires walking, walking before someone. And Eli, the man who sits, can't do this anymore. By using the image of the sitting man and the language of walking, and just to remind you, Elkanah was a man who traveled every year regularly. It's in Shmuel's blood to be someone who walks, to be someone who travels. We create this contrast once again, or we highlight once again the contrast between the dynamism represented by Chana and the passivity that becomes corrupted represented by Eli's son. The next few chapters in the book show us what are the natural consequences of each of these attitudes. Because what God promised to bring to bear does come to bear. Eli's house collapses. It collapses when Hophni and Pinchas, his sons, come with the people to fight a war against the Plishtim, and in a misguided moment decide to bring with them the Aron HaKodesh, the English word escapes me.
The Holy Ark.
Thank you very much. The Holy Ark itself into battle without asking God's permission. They do. They lose the war, and they are killed. Many people die, and the Ark is taken captive. And when a messenger comes to tell it to Eli, when he hears all these news, and especially in the moment when he hears that the Ark itself, which is the core of the place where he is the guardian, where he is one enforcing order, was taken, he falls back and dies. But guess in what position he is when he does? Any guesses? He's sitting down. He exits the story in exactly the same position he entered it. And it's in the source sheet. We don't have time to go and look at it right now, but I'm inviting you to look at it later. Just as he entered the story, sitting down, he exits the story sitting down. Because despite the fact that he's a kind man, a man of God, a righteous man, passivity is not enough to shape reality. Passivity is not enough to snap us out of the cycle of the judges era and build something better. And in contrast, we see, in contrast, we see the rise of Shmuel, who starts as this server, as this man who serves Eli in his work and impresses everybody and is beloved by everybody and is eventually entrusted by God with prophecy. Tragically, his first prophecy is an iteration of the same message to Eli, telling him that he and his house will fall. And he has to go and tell it to his beloved mentor. Remember that, because we will see that his last prophecy will also be bringing bad tidings to somebody he loves. But we will get back to that in a different class. Eli, if Eli is passive and declines, Shmuel is active and rises. And after Eli's death, after Eli's kind of falling out of the story, after Eli falls out of the story, Shmuel takes charge and starts shaping reality with a type of leadership that marks him very much as his parents' son. Because like his father, who traveled every year to the center of ritual, Shmuel travels every year to judge the people in their cities. He does a circuit. He doesn't just sit there by himself waiting for people to come to him. No, he's actively going around judging, bringing judgment, bringing Torah, bringing truth to people and helping them live their life actively in various places. There's more to say about that, but we don't have time. At the same time, he's not repeating the pattern of the other judges we met. The judges we met in the book of Judges, who rise in a moment of military crisis and then sometimes try to also create law and order afterwards. But their main call, their main rise to fame has to do with a military function that they have to fulfill. With Shmuel, we're seeing the opposite. Shmuel first rises as a judge, as a civil judge. He goes, he brings judgment. He calls upon the Israelites. He coaxes them to return to God. He tells them to get rid of their idols. He gathers them up for prayer. He brings them all together into one place. He unifies them to bring them together in front of God, to recreate the covenant. And only then does he become a military leader. Because when the Philistines hear that the Israelites gathered in one place for prayer, they think, surely they gathered there in order to muster for arms, to get ready for war against us. So they attack. And then the people are very, very scared. The Jews, the Israelites are very, very scared. And Shmuel says, don't be scared. We can do it. And he gathers them and he fights and he wins. He chases the Philistines quite far. And when they reach the end of their chase, he puts a rock there and he says, until this point, God helped us. This is the point to which God helped us reach. In other words, from the moment of victory itself, he's dedicating the victory to God. He's immediately helping the people to create a connection in their mind between the military achievement and their covenant with God. And he's naming the place. What does it mean to name a place? It means that you're laying down a marker. You're making it impossible for people to forget that this place is not just a place where we won a war, it's a place where God helped us. So Shmuel takes all this active, dynamic spirit that he inherited from his traveling father and his non-conventional mother. He translated it into a lifetime of traveling around, pushing people to renew their covenant with God, leading them militarily when necessary, but not exclusively in a military capacity. And by doing all of that, he lays the groundwork for them to be one united people instead of a tribal society. The problem is that just like Eli before him, Shmuel is human, which means that at some point he reaches old age. And at some point the question rises in the people's mind, what will happen after? What will happen when Shmuel dies? What will happen when this unique man who led them so much more thoroughly than their previous great leaders will be no more. Now, if they'll just continue the pattern of the judges, we know what's going to happen, right? He's going to die. His work will crumble. The messages he finally brought back, the knowledge of their connection with God, will not be passed forward from generation to generation. They'll forget, and they'll sink back into the same horrific judges status quo from before. We don't want that. Shmuel doesn't want that. The people don't want that. And the people think that there's only one way to stop their reality from reverting backwards. And this way is to have a king. Is to stop being ruled by whichever leader God chooses at any given moment, or whichever ruler they choose at a given moment, but rather to have an organized dynastic rule where everybody knows what happens with the death of one king, where there's no civil war every time there's no leader, where there's no forgetfulness because there is one government center that will pass on the system, the power, the knowledge, and help us build upon it. Now, they don't phrase it exactly in these terms. Here's what they say. I'm jumping ahead here. I'm jumping ahead to box seven, to what happens in the eighth chapter of Shmuel. All the elders of Israel assembled and came to Shmuel in Ramah, and they said to him, "You have grown old, and your sons have not followed your ways. Therefore, appoint a king for us to govern us like all other nations." Shmuel was displeased with what they said. "Give us a king to govern us." Shmuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord replied to Shmuel, "Heed the demand of the people and everything they say to you. For it is not you that they have rejected, it is me they have rejected as their king." Something about this request, that on the face of it seems like such a natural solution to the problems of the judges era. It'll create stability. Stability will allow for greater unity. It'll be centralized, so the tribes will work together better. It will allow for a passage of information and power from generation to generation, so they will stop forgetting their covenant with God. And yet, something about this solution is unattractive. It's even repugnant to Shmuel and to God as well. And the question is, why? What about this solution? What about this fix for the problem of the judges era is so undesirable in the eyes of Shmuel? I'll be happy to hear your answers in a minute. I just want to respect everybody's time by finishing my part of the lecture here with three answers, three possible answers, and then I'll be happy to open it to discussion and hear your comments and suggestions and stay further. First and foremost, what we've seen so far in the book of Judges was that the problem was never geopolitical. The problem was educational. If the people had passed on their identity, if the people had passed on their covenant with God and with each other as members of one nation, the geopolitical problems wouldn't have been as acute. But because people stopped focusing on who they are in relation to God and in relation to each other, but rather focused on their personal self-interest or tribal self-interest, they grew weak. They couldn't count on each other's help. They couldn't count on God's help. And that's what made them vulnerable for encroachment for other nations. Now, a king might fix the geopolitical problem, but a king might also exacerbate the deeper problem. Because if a king constantly remembers that he is God's servant and teaches other people to look at him as God's servant, then he can well become, like Shmuel, a connection between the people and God and a reminder of the covenant. But if a king becomes convinced in his own power, or if his children who inherit the kingdom from him become convinced of their own power, he can become instead a something that separates the people, something that severs their relationship with God, and they can come to rely on the king instead of on God and their conduct. And instead of being a solution to the deep problem of judges, the king can lead them astray. In fact, we don't need to speak in hypotheticals. The book of Kings is full of stories like that, of kings that led the people astray. And in the end, led them all the way to the destruction of Jerusalem that we remember in these 3 weeks in the Jewish calendar. All the way down there, they were led by kings. So perhaps this is one reason of concern and why God feels that by asking for a king, they're rejecting him. Because in a sense, what they want is a buffer, is someone else to deal with God and give them a certain sense of stability that doesn't stem from keeping their end of the covenant. So this is one problem, that this solution solves the surface problem, but not the deep problem of the era. Another possible answer of why Shmuel is so discontent or unhappy with the solution, and this is the reason he actually gives the people, is that power leads to corruption. We saw that already just in today's class, right? Just in the beginning of this book, we saw how the sons of a righteous man become corrupt and use their power. Hophni and Pinchas use their power to abuse women and to take things that don't belong to them, to take things from people and from God, even things that are under God's protection. So what would stop the king from doing the same? If status quo by its nature keeps things from being dynamic and allows things to become passive and later corrupt, what would stop the kingship as an institution from leading the people from a reality where, yes, they're somewhat anarchic, and yes, they often have problems on the geopolitical plane, but overall, no one has enough power over them to exploit them from within themselves? What guarantees do they have that this relative protection from internal corruption will persist when they give a king the power to take advantage of them? And this is, in fact, what Shmuel does. Under God's instructions, he explains to the people that a king will be allowed to take things from them, take their children, take their possessions, take their labor, take their money, take. And the people accept the cost. The people say, okay, but the anarchy we have right now, we just can't live with that. We prefer to live with a corrupted status quo than with nothing at all. The third answer is, in fact, already intertwined in the two answers I gave before, is the problem of dynasty. How do you, even if you choose a wonderful king, as Ecclesiastes says, sometimes a wise king has a stupid son. The second you choose kingship, monarchy, as your paradigm of governance, you're allowing chance an enormous power over your children's lives. Because there's nothing at all to protect you from the accidents of bad apples, even in a good bunch. Worse, as we know from what we will see in the following classes that happens in the book of Samuel, but also from all history of all monarchs, children who grow up in power in the court often become corrupt and reckless and dangerous in ways that a chosen king like Shaul or like David or like the judges, someone who is chosen for some attributes in him, does not. These three problems don't go away. Shmuel assents to the people's request and helps them to find a king, and we will talk next week about the first king and their problems. But what will happen now will be an attempt to create kingship in Israel that will somehow be inoculated against these encroaching problems, that will somehow succeed at creating centralization and stabilization in the anarchy that was the judges' era, without succumbing to corruption and the corruption of the status quo that we saw foreshadowed in the dynasty of priests in Shiloh, and that we see in Shmuel's worries as he accepts and accedes to the people's request. This will be where the story takes us forward. How do we establish a king but not lose touch with God, not become corrupt, and not become completely dependent upon chance in the matter of dynastic rule, in the matter of who the heirs are? Thank you. And thank you for everybody who's still here. And let's go over the questions, comments, and if you want to add anything, please do. I'm happy to answer. I'm not going to be able to answer everything. I'll answer what I can and also what I think we did not already touch upon. A moment. iPad, again, I don't know who iPad is, pointed out something interesting, which is the very fact that the woman here in this story, Chana, makes such a major decision about the fate of her son is significant. The very fact that Chana says, and if I have a son, I will give him to you, God, without asking Elkanah for permission, is another indication of just how daring she is in a sense. Joan Sachs pointed out that the story of Eli and Chana also shows us that God isn't only within the temple. There is no gatekeeper. God is everywhere and available. God is everywhere and available to all men and women. It's true. It's a very powerful story that shows us that even though the priests have some sort of monopoly over how things are done in the Beit HaMikdash, and it's not a man-made monopoly, it's instituted in Leviticus by God himself, there's a certain closeness to God that is open to all of us all the time. And in effect, when the priests are trying to use that to police people, it's problematic, it leads to problems. Someone pointed out that the Bible is full of women who are strong and who need to be. This is a very good point, often surrounding the issues of fertility, which I want to point out is not just the question of one woman's happiness as a mother. It's also the question of continuity of the human race. That women stand up and say, I want to have children, is not just I want to have children, it's I want to have a hand in shaping the world that will be after me. There's an interesting halachic discussion in the comments about whether women are allowed to make vows or not. I'm not going to go into that because we're focusing here on storytelling and less on the on Jewish law. Somebody pointed out that the original Grimm's fairy tales don't have the problem of the fairy tales I read to my daughter where nothing changes and people just have happy lives. Very true. Someone else pointed out, Nomi pointed out that the fact that Chana as a akara, as an infertile, barren woman, prays for a child, places her, alludes to the stories of the matriarchs. It places her in very good society, so to speak. And it's true. We spoke a little bit about that in one of our previous classes, that biblical storytellers, biblical stories often use what's called type scenes, as Robert Adler calls it, meaning certain scenes repeat themselves in variations, and by paying attention to this, we understand something deeper about each iteration of the story. And it's an interesting project. We don't have time to do it right now, but I invite you to look at it. In what ways does Chana's prayer differ from the attitudes of other famous barren women in the Tanakh? It's a surprising and interesting exercise. Moment. Somebody pointed out that Chana's bravery is parallel to the bravery of the daughter of Tzlefchad that we are meeting in this week's Parsha, I believe, unless I'm confused. No, I don't remember. Either this week or next week, who go to Moses at the time in our time in the desert and ask or perhaps demand their father's inheritance and say they have no brothers. Moses goes and asks God, who says to give the land to them. This takes tremendous chutzpah. They don't ask the men around them. They go right to Moses and then by extension, he to God. True. And I think that this is a model that repeats itself as a positive model throughout the Tanakh. Just a moment. Karen Lovinger pointed out that while Eli doesn't succeed at telling off his sons, he is also the man who raises Shmuel. This is very true. And in fact, one of the hallmarks of the biblical narrative we started today, the story of Shmuel, is the tragedy that stems from the fact that often good people are entangled in the wrong path, or are good but not good enough in some way. There are two men in Eli's life that are extremely important to him. The mentor, not Eli, sorry, in Shmuel's life, his mentor Eli, and later the first king he will anoint, Shaul, who we are told literally, we don't have to guess it, we're told explicitly that Shmuel loved him. And yet in both of these relationships, Shmuel found himself in a position where, because God told him to, he had to go and give them bad news. He had to basically tell them that their house will not continue to be leaders under God. And in both cases, both in Eli's cases, and then we will discuss in length next week, Shaul's cases, we're not talking about evil people. We're talking about people who have many great attributes. And yet in some way, it's not enough. And when we talk about Shaul, we will see that some of what makes him the wrong choice to continue the kingship is similar to what made Eli the wrong choice. But we will leave that for next week. Someone pointed out that the fact that God wouldn't let Eli's sons listen to Eli's warning reminds us of when God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Very true. Just a moment. There's an interesting discussion in the comments about Eli as someone who is both a mentor for Shmuel and a problematic character. And Joan Sachs wrote that perhaps Eli is sitting and should still be respected. And I think the character is described as overall positive, yet somehow wrong for the times. Yet somehow wrong in the way it handles reality. And I agree with you, Joan, when you say that we, like the sages in rabbinical stories, we're encouraged to show kavod, to show respect to Eli, even though in some way his way of doing things means that he is outdated, means that he needs to be set aside for a new leadership to rise. He is still someone worthy of respect. It does not change that. iPad wrote, going around the country, seeing how people actually live is important because at the central altar, you tend to see people proudly dressed in their best, laden with animals and such to sacrifice. Whereas around the country, you see a broader mix of people and economic situations. This is a very good point. And by the way, I want you to remember the old emphasis on travel. In Hannah's rising up, and then in Shmuel, in Elkanah's traveling, and then in Shmuel's travel, regular travel to see the people and to meet them in their own places or to be there for them and judge them where they are. Because this very trait, the ability to travel a lot, or the fact of traveling a lot, will also be something that makes David particularly suited for the job. And in fact, God will constantly talk about David as the man who walks before him. Even in the book of Kings, when God talks to David's descendants, he will constantly reiterate this trait. He'll constantly go back to the fact that David walked. And we have to wonder how much of David's unique ability to unite the people had to do with the fact that in his youth, he had to travel. Because he was chased by Shaul, because he was an outcast, he had to travel and meet all kinds of people in all kinds of walks of life instead of growing up in relative stability and knowing only one place very well. So this too will become important. Moment. Okay, I'm afraid that I do have to go for now, so I'm going to wrap up here. I do want to make one comment as we move towards next week. As we move from the request for kingship to kingship, which is that when Shmuel accedes to the people's request to make a king, he gives them a sign. He does a weird thing. It was the summer, the days when they reap the wheat, and he prays for rain. And it rains, and the people beg him to pray to God to stop the rain. And he says, okay. And he prays, and the rain stops. And he points out to the people that if they follow God, the king will be for the good. If they don't follow God, the king will die, like themselves. In other words, if they allow themselves to think that the king itself, the king himself, is a solution to all their problems, they should forget that. The king only works if there's also a deeper level of loyalty to God himself underlying this. But why this sign? Why use rain in the wrong time of the year as a sign? I'm not going to answer this question now. I want to leave it with you for the week. And if you want to share your thoughts about it next week or an email form, I'll be happy to hear it. And then let's have that in the back of our mind as we enter the actual rise of kingship, which is what we've been working towards in the past 5 weeks as we move forward. So I'm wishing you all a wonderful week and a wonderful day for you, I guess. Afternoon, I'm not even sure. For me, it's nighttime. I'm going to bed. But okay, thank you so much.